From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Week in Review checks in on the race for the Massachusetts 7th and big plans from the White House.
The time has come to establish the United States Space Force.
Also today, Governor Baker signed 53 bills into law. One of them establishes automatic voter registration in Massachusetts. Advocacy groups like Common Cause say it's a big step forward.
Registration has been one of the most significant barriers to participation that we have seen over the years.
We'll check in with WBUR's Steve Brown to hear what's still lingering on the governor's desk. Plus, comedian John Hodgman on vacation homes and bad facial hair.
All weird dads grow mustaches. It's the evolutionary signal to the world that they're all done. Our children are out there. Our evolutionary purpose is no longer needed. So hello, mating people. No, thank you.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's jump right into our Week in Review, starting with the battle for the 7th Congressional District here in Massachusetts. Challenger City Councilor Ayanna Pressley said at a debate this week that the 7th needs a new activist voice.
What this district deserves and what these times require is activist leadership, someone that will be a movement and a coalition builder, because ultimately a vote on the floor of Congress will not defeat the hate coming out of that White House. Only a movement can.
But 10-term incumbent Congressman Michael Capuano defended his long record in the House, saying that with time comes expertise.
It does take a while to learn how to get things done in Congress. I've been there for a while, and my record speaks for itself. My record both of not just voting the right way, but also advocating for the right things, pushing for the right items, both nationally and locally.
However, Ayanna Pressley says votes are not enough.
Seniority and leadership can't just be defined by number of years served or how you vote. It's about impact in this district.
On the other hand, Capuano says advocacy and votes do go hand in hand.
Votes are important. And by the way, when Democrats are in the majority, we brought health care to 20 million people.
So obviously the big question here is, what does this race say about the direction that the Democratic Party as a whole might go? So joining me now to discuss that is Tom Nichols. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. He's also a professor at the Harvard Extension School. Tom Nichols, it's great to see you. Welcome.
It's great to be back with you, Meghna.
It's good to have you here as part of our Week in Review team. Also with us is Tiziana Deering. She's a professor and co-director at the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College. She's also a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Tiziana, it's good to see you again.
Thanks. Good to be here.
All right. So, Tiziana, let me just start with you. We had a pretty raucous debate sponsored by WBUR, The Globe, and UMass Boston between Capuano and Pressley this week. I mean, what do you make of this race so far?
Yeah, it was a raucous and healthy debate. And what I thought several times while I was listening to it is, actually, this is really good for the 7th District of Massachusetts, and this is really good for Massachusetts as a whole. It was a tense, respectful debate, but these are strong candidates with good track records who, if you're a Democrat, are both going to care about issues that are bread and butter for you, and it's healthy to have this kind of contest. And I was really impressed with both of them, and the sort of dividing lines, Meghna, that they were highlighting are the ones. I mean, this is a microcosm of the challenge that we're going to have in the passing of baton and leadership in this country over and over again in the decades to come.
Mm. Now, the 7th in Massachusetts is the state's only majority-minority congressional district, and so that's something that we asked Councillor Pressley about whether or not race is a factor in this election, and here's what she said.
Race is a factor in everything. Representation does matter. That is not the impetus for my run, but I'm not going to pretend that representation doesn't matter. It matters because it informs the issues that are spotlighted and emphasized, and it leads to more innovative and enduring solutions.
Now, on the other hand, once again, Congressman Capuano responded by saying he agrees that race matters, but he also said his experience is what matters.
Certainly, first of all, agree that race does matter, as does gender, as does gender identity. Of course they matter. That's why we fight so hard for civil rights and human rights, to make sure that society embraces differences amongst us and recognizes that differences are okay.
Now, Tom Nichols, being a resident of Rhode Island, I'm going to give you a pass on saying that if you have any details on the race here in the 7th. But really, I think one of the reasons why it's actually garnered a lot of national attention is because there is this question about the direction the Democratic Party is going to go. We had other races this week that I think say that, you know, not everyone is getting on the advocacy bandwagon.
Right. And I should add, by the way, that I cut my teeth in politics by working for a few years in the Massachusetts State House because, of course, I am a native son of the Commonwealth, just living to the south for now. And I should remind everybody I don't represent the Navy in anything I'm saying. You know, as one of these apostate never-Trump Republicans who is wishing the Democrats well and wants to – I'm one of the people like George Will, like Michael Gerson, like others who have said that the only way out of this is for the Democrats to win in November. And so I want the Democrats to do well. I worry about the degree to which these kinds of issues become nationalized. I think that's been a consistent mistake that the Democratic Party, which, let's face it, has hemorrhaged 1,000 seats over the past 10 years at all levels of government. I mean, it has been a wipeout of Democratic seats that I think was obscured by the popularity of Barack Obama. It's something that was easy to forget because Obama was so popular. That's in part because the Democrats make the mistake of nationalizing these issues. I mean, that's practically a Republican ad to have a Democratic candidate say everything is about race.
Okay. Well, but let me ask you, though. I mean, nationalizing certain issues, isn't that exactly what the Republican Party has been doing for many election cycles?
I would say if you look at what the Republicans were doing in much more productive races at the city, state, regional level, that's where they were really building the party apparatus. And there was, at least until this past few years, a much bigger tent among the Republicans. Sort of as long as you voted for the caucus, you got a pass on other things. I think Republicans were better about not purity testing each other out of existence at those lower levels.
I don't know about that, TT.
Well, I also don't feel that this was a nationalized issue. I mean, you've got a black woman running against a white man in a majority-minority district where the majority of the voters are white, but the majority of the residents are black. So, of course, it's partly about race. We can't ignore the fact that Ayanna Pressley is an African-American woman and Mike Capuano is a white man. At the same time, you know, in my classes, I used to teach protest 2 or 3 years ago and advocacy, social action like that, and my students would treat it as a history lesson. When I treat it in class now, they treat it like what they did last weekend, right? So the younger base is moving in a new direction, and we will experience these tensions, I think, on the progressive side of the aisle for a while, but this is inevitable, and I think this is a truly local race that is being cast into a national spotlight, but is about the 7th district.
I can't tell you how strange it is to me, though, as somebody who's even – I actually worked for the Democrats when I was a younger man in my misspent youth in the State House. But I can't tell you how strange it is to me after years of being on the other side to see Michael Capuano, you know, being suspect as not being progressive enough.
Mm. Oh, but I don't think that's what this is about. I don't think it's about whether he's progressive enough. I think it's about – I think – Councilwoman Pressley said this in the debate. It's about how you go at getting the laws passed. I really don't hear it as a fight about who's more progressive, but I do hear it as a discussion about how lived experience affects your intention and attention when you bring yourself to the floor.
I'm sorry. I think that exactly captures a lot of the debate in America today, to say you have to have this lived experience in order to be authentic. I think this divides a lot of voters to say, you know, Michael Capuano may have been I have no dog in this fight either regionally or politically, other than to say, you know, of course a Democrat is going to win the 7th district. But I think it is an important division that's taking place right now to say it doesn't matter if you're a 10-term Republican, if you are not representative demographically of this district. I mean, we just saw that happen in New York with the same situation. And to me, I mean, I understand, you know, ethnic politics. I mean, in an earlier generation, it was Polish Catholics, Italians, others saying we want to have representatives from our community. On the other hand, I think internecine warfare over this at a time when I think that there's a much more existential danger isn't productive.
Let me just jump in here, because about the 7th in particular, I mean, this is actually something, you know, Michael Capuano called it, he said it's unfortunate there has to be a family fight here. But I still wonder, well, when you have the power of incumbency like you do in a blue state like Massachusetts, when are we ever going to get new voices? It'll always be by de facto a family fight in any primary race. And so, you know, for the purposes of modernizing any party, Republican or Democrat, I think, you know, a good primary challenge is always, it's always a good idea.
And I think more people ought to vote in primaries, because that's how you get the practice of increasing turnout. And again, I think Republicans were always, you know, quietly better about this, of just getting people to get into the habit of voting and showing up for things like primaries and midterms.
Tom, there's one thing I want to ask you, then Tiziana, I'll let you jump in here. But you said that Republicans didn't necessarily have a purity test in previous election cycles. But don't they have one now, and his name is Donald Trump?
Notice I carefully, my careful circumlocution where I said, up until the past few years. I mean, now there is, in fact, a, you know, sort of white hot purity test. And I think it's bad for the Republicans. I think it's bad for America. I think it's bad for everybody. But yeah, it's definitely there now.
Well, I just think in a world where you don't have term limits, how else are we supposed to ever have new leadership ever? Right. We can't just always have a case where you wait until somebody's done and then you run. I understand the tensions here with the councilwoman and the representative, especially because she's a young, powerful leader who, by the way, has multiple aspects to her identity. She's also a woman. She's also young. You know, she's got a number of other aspects to her identity that I think figure into her platform as well. But in the absence of term limits, we should expect and embrace challenges in primaries, because they make both candidates stronger. They bring new issues to the table. They strengthen the democratic system. And sometimes they're the only way to get to changes in leadership.
I only have one concern about that. And my concern, and this would be in any party, regardless of ideology, that I think you're absolutely right. I think primaries keep the incumbents on their toes, because they get fat and lazy and happy and rich. And their war chests swell, and they can stomp out. I mean, as a political scientist, I can tell you that normally by the third term of a congressman's tenure, he or she's pretty much indestructible.
Mm-hmm.
But I worry about the challenge being based solely on you don't look like people in the district.
That worries me when that becomes a major thing. I don't think that's fair to the councilwoman, though, about what she's doing.
I only heard the debate, and I haven't, you know.
To be fair to her, I actually think it's we in the Boston media who have repeatedly forced the race question onto her, and that's our duty.
In Boston?
Shocking.
What
I know.
A shock.
But that's our duty. Because of the particularities of the 7th district. Again, it's a majority-minority district, and it has never had a person of color representing it in Washington. And I always get a little twitchy when candidates avoid answering the question, which Ayanna Pressley sometimes has. I mean, she at least very forthrightly, this week was the first time I ever heard her come out after I pushed her say, yes, race does matter. But in addition, she said there's more to her candidacy. So but that's why this is so interesting, though, right? Because it's like, could it be a national issue, but it's also a highly local one. But I'm going to move on to more other stuff in just a second. But there's one last thing about this race and politics in Massachusetts question that I want to ask. I mean, especially regarding the Democratic Party, nationally, we have heard Democrats, you know, in big races like the Senate race down in Alabama, saying black women saved the party. Black women, 98% of black women voted for the Democratic candidate. And yet, you know, here we have a case in which that self same party, the leaders of that party, when a new young African-American voice comes onto the scene, None of the Democratic Party leadership has allied behind Ayanna Pressley. So it's an interesting tension here. Like, on the one hand, the party will say black women form the heart and soul of the Democratic Party nationally, but on the other hand, when a new young voice arises, they're not throwing their weight behind her. I mean, I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah, I think it is, at a human level, at a species level, incredibly difficult to give up power. I think it's just really, really difficult to give up power. And I think part of the concern is that Representative Capuano has seniority and power in that chamber that is helpful and important. And when you bring in someone new, it shakes things.
Well,
and
also,
it's scary to give up.
But that's not nothing.
And they don't disagree on the issues, right? I mean, that's the other thing.
Let's not just dismiss that, though, as, I mean, again, maybe I, you know, am influenced by having come out of elected politics at the city, state, and I actually worked in the U.S. Senate for a while. I mean, when you talk about seniority and power and rank, that helps the people in your district. And it's a tough thing to say, listen, we're going to start all over again with somebody who has none of that.
He's up by 13 points. So I think, you know, I think there are a lot of folks in the district that agree with you. And I think this is the tension, which brings me back to, in the absence of term limits, are there ways to handle that transfer of power? This is the kind of stuff we're going to see.
Incumbency is deadly. It is.
And it is definitely a fact of political life in Massachusetts, let me tell you. All right. So just let's take a couple minutes to pull out the periscope and look around nationally a little bit, because we do have to talk about President Trump. It's been a busy week. This week, the president's lawyers are saying that Trump wants to talk with Robert Mueller, but they've advised the president against that. Here's Rudy Giuliani on Fox News on Wednesday night.
He knows the answers to every question that he wants to ask. He's going to ask him, did you tell Comey to go easy on Flynn? The president's going to say, no, I didn't. Hey, Bob, you know it. Why do you want to get him under oath? You think we're fools? You want to get him under oath because you want to trap him into perjury. Well, we're not going to let you do that.
Okay, Tom, teeing that one up for you.
Wow. Well, first of all, you know, when you hear Rudy Giuliani, it's almost easy to forget that this was once a feared prosecutor in the Southern District of New York. I mean, this is like your retired uncle after a couple of drinks at the Thanksgiving table, giving you legal advice that constantly conflicts with itself. But in the end, no lawyer can be better than the client. That's the problem here. Now, let's take one moment to be fair to Giuliani and even to the president, which is people say, well, the easiest way to avoid a perjury trap is to just tell the truth. And most lawyers would tell you that's not quite true. You can make a lot of mistakes, as Bill Clinton learned the hard way. You can make a lot of mistakes when you talk to a prosecutor. But nonetheless, you know, this hold me back. I really want to talk to Mueller, but my lawyers are telling me I can't. I mean, this is just kabuki and nonsense of the first order. They don't want him to talk to Mueller because the president can't stay on message. He has no serious attention span for stuff like this. And he's going to blurt something out. And go off message. And, you know, the president is a walking bundle of Kinsley and gaffes, where the gaffe is to tell the truth when he's not scripted.
So what do you think?
Yeah, I think that he can't stay on message is generous. I think he lies a lot.
Oh, yeah.
He lies like as a way of life. And I think the irony of Rudy Giuliani's comments from Wednesday night is, I mean, I'm amazed at the extent to which anymore you have to talk about the things that people are saying and then what was actually said. And this is one of those moments. There's the words that came out of his mouth and then there was what was actually said, which was, we put this guy under deposition, he's going to lie a ton because he does, and then they're going to have him on perjury. But that's not entrapment, right? If you've got a guy who can't tell the truth, it's not entrapment to make him answer questions.
The thing about not staying on message, all I meant by that is, even if they agree that Mueller can only ask certain questions, because that's the new thing, right? It's like, well, if Mueller agrees to stay in this lane, they know the president won't stay in that lane. He'll move on to the thing he wants to talk about, and that could be anything at any given moment. So it's not only the problem of continued falsehoods and lies that are, you know, easily disprovable, which I think is one of the strangest things about this administration, but it will be, even if his people negotiate careful lanes, he won't stay in them, and they know it.
Let me just ask both of you a quick question before we move on here. Sometimes I wonder if Rudy Giuliani is playing the long game. Like, he's playing the PR game, because I think he's banking on the likelihood that no matter what Robert Mueller comes up with, that, like, no charges are going to be brought. The House isn't going to do anything. The Senate isn't going to do anything. Oh, you're giving me that look, Tom. But shoring up support amongst the president's base, however, is going to be far more important and effective in the long run.
I think Giuliani's doing two things. One is he's getting things out in public that are damaging that the president has already, shall we say, been inaccurate about. And that way, when Mueller reveals it, they can fall back on old news. Rudy already told you this. The other thing, as you say, is to prime the base not to believe anything.
Yep.
Which is deeply concerning and pernicious. I mean, to basically say, so here's our strategy. In order to preserve power, we're going to undermine people's faith in everything so that we can keep power just makes you a jerk. Yeah. It just does. And it's really disheartening to see that strategy playing out so blatantly.
Tom,
you've been quoting 1984 on your Twitter.
I have.
So it's... Yeah, it's disturbing. All right, well, I want to shift gears entirely and do some good news because we've got just enough time left for our hubbubs. Now, those are the smaller stories or events that caught our attention this week but maybe didn't make it above the fold or the top of the newscast, whatever you like. Tiziana, you go first.
I couldn't resist because last time I was here, my hubbub was Alan Dershowitz complaining about the fact that he doesn't get invited to fancy cocktail parties
on Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah. So ironically, this is my first week back since then. And guess who's on the vineyard this week? Barack Obama, who not only am I quite sure is getting invited to every swanky cocktail party he wants, was actually greeted with people lining rooftops and the sides of buildings and cheering him and clapping, which both, you know, just A, let's compare and contrast. And B, both serve to remind me of everything that will never happen to me when I go to Martha's Vineyard.
I'd clap for you right now, though.
Thank you.
No, if I had a rooftop to stand, I would. Tom Nichols, your hubbub.
It's an all-vineyard hubbub today. I am sad to report, because I admire him and his work so much, that Bill Murray roughed up a photographer, but... Because, and what makes it the most vineyard thing ever is the photographer was Carly Simon's brother. Oh. So, like, this is just the vineyard story of all time, right? Carly Simon's brother taking pictures. Bill Murray roughs him up because he thinks the guy is stalking him. And the punchline, he didn't know who Bill Murray was.
Oh. Dear.
So you have, you know, the only thing that would have made it better is if Murray had shoved him against the wall, which he did, and then said, "Back off, man. I'm a scientist."
Okay, it's my turn. Now, on most weeks, I usually, like, scramble into the studio at the last second, and I tell everyone, oh, my God, my staff, I don't have a hubbub, and they magically pull one out of a hat. The same thing has happened this week, except I have been told by them that I'm not supposed to have a hubbub, and, in fact, I am required – I'm getting a little scared – I'm required to go to this piece of tape. So, guys, do what you're going to do.
Hi, Meghna. It's your director. I'm on the other side of the glass today because we, the current and former producers of the show, have got our own hubbub for you today. We all want to wish you a farewell and good luck at On Point.
When I got to Radio Boston, I was really hungry for a mentor, and Meghna, you were that for me in a way that I am still so grateful for.
Meghna taught me how to bring my whole self to work and to be more fulfilled as a result, how to use the things that are maybe nerdy or weird or different about you to make your work more interesting and vibrant.
I'm so inspired by your passion and enthusiasm for the work that you do and for your drive to get to the truth of real stories that affect real people.
From your sharp wit, your profound insights, your creativity, and your willingness to always try something new and different.
I'm still in awe of the passion that you bring to everything.
I admire your tenacity, your grit, and your smarts, and the way you do it all with so much grace and a touch of humor, just the right touch of humor.
You've taught me to be kind, to be fierce, to be bold, to chase stories, and to not give up.
You've taught me so much in the time that I've worked with you and been a fierce advocate for me personally and for my work, and for that I am forever grateful.
We've had so much fun every day, and you inspire us all, and I can't imagine this show without you, because in so many ways you are the heart and soul of Radio Boston. So good luck at On Point. We're all going to miss you. And remember, you'll always have a home here.
Gosh darn it, guys! Oh, look, they're all standing back there in the studio. Oh my God. Okay. First of all, you guys are the heart and soul of Radio Boston. Don't do this to me. But thank you so much. Thank you so much. I can't tell you how much it's been a privilege to work with all of those people who you just heard from. They have made the past 8 years an absolute, absolute joy, and I have had the best time, and I've learned so much from them. But I have to make, I've got to finish this segment now. I still have a job to do. So I love all of you. I love this program. And you will, listeners who are listening right now, I want you to know that because of the staff of Radio Boston, you will all be in excellent hands. And I can't wait to be a listener and hear all that they will do in the coming years. So Tom Nichols, welcome. This is what we do here on Week in Review. He's a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and also at the Harvard Extension School. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here for you with you for this show.
And Tiziana Deering, professor and co-director at the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Thank you, Tiziana.
It's been such a privilege, Meghna.
Okay, we're not quite done yet. We will be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Governor Charlie Baker signed 53 bills into law yesterday, including a major opioid bill, an automatic voter registration law, and a clean energy bill. But there is still business left to be done. So joining us now with more is WBUR Statehouse reporter Steve Brown. He's on Beacon Hill. Hello, Steve.
Hey there, Meghna.
Okay, so the business left to be done has to do with the economic development bill. What's the status of that?
It's been done. Just about 10 minutes ago, I got an email from the governor's office telling me that he has signed the economic development bill, signed 64 sections, vetoed 2, and is amending 6. The one that everybody's paying attention to, though, of course, is the sales tax holiday. He signed that. The sales tax holiday will take effect tomorrow and Sunday. You can go buy that big screen TV and not shell out the tax.
Good. I mean, it would have been awfully strange if all those people, everyone waiting for tomorrow's sales tax holiday couldn't do it in the end. But is there anything special to note about the parts of the economic development bill that the governor did veto?
He vetoed the part that restricted patent trolling.
Oh, interesting.
I haven't had a chance to read through everything there because, like I say, it just came through a little while ago when I was listening to that tribute to you. And so I got to catch up on that, but I know that the patent trolling language is out of there. And he did amend six things, and will go back to the legislature. But they're gone, so they won't be able to really do anything.
I see. Okay. Patent trolling. Interesting. Okay. So I'm going to keep up with you on as you dig into that in the future. But let's talk about the stuff that the governor did pass. I mean, 53 bills as of yesterday, I guess now more than that. Tell us about this automatic voter registration bill.
Yeah, that comes at a time when the importance of voting is often in the news. It was strongly supported in both the House and the Senate. Massachusetts is the 14th state to adopt automatic voting. In essence, what the bill does is when you either go get your driver's license renewed or if you apply for MassHealth, you'll also be registered to vote unless you opt out. Now, Secretary of State Bill Galvin says that it will be ready to go in time for the presidential primaries of 2020. It won't have any effect on the upcoming elections this fall.
Okay. Now, another bill that the governor did sign was the opioid bill. He's long said this was a major priority for him, but not everything he wanted made it into the final legislation, right?
No, it's not exactly as he had proposed it. He's still pleased with it. They said that it has about 90% of what he wanted. It requires that folks who show up in an ER or an involuntary commitment facility who are suffering from an overdose be given medication-assisted treatment. The facilities can't just release them back out onto the street. It does not contain the 72-hour involuntary treatment provision, which is what the governor had asked for. Also creates a commission to recommend credentials for recovery coaches.
Well, that's WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown giving us the latest from Beacon Hill, where the last couple of bills that were waiting to be dealt with the governor, he's working his way through them. So it's been a busy time at the governor's office. Steve, thank you so very much.
Thanks, Meghna, and good luck on the new gig.
Thanks. John Hodgman is a comedian, an actor, and the author of the hilarious comedy memoir Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches. In Vacation Land, Hodgman writes of his experiences growing up and growing older in New England. And in the book, he slyly admits to being the owner of not one, but two summer homes. One out in western Massachusetts, the state he calls the birthplace of rage and spite, and the other on the beaches of Maine, a place where he says he will one day inevitably accept his death. I spoke with Hodgman about Vacation Land last November. I couldn't make it through the first 5 or 6 pages of your book without cracking up repeatedly.
Thank you very much.
So what is the inspiration for Vacation Land? And why turn to true stories from your own life when you have done so well with fake facts beforehand?
Well, you know, my first three books were these imaginary almanacs of fake trivia and invented historical facts. Absurdist humor, basically. And it put me onto The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, where I took on this persona of a deranged authority, the resident expert, and then later the deranged millionaire. And yes, I did quite well with it for a while. But though they were all fake, there was always a certain honesty there. I was honestly preoccupied with the fake history of the hobo wars in the 1920s and those kinds of jokes. But I reached a certain point, I don't think coincidentally when I hit 40, when I didn't feel like being totally fake all the time. And I started doing more stand-up that was much more straightforward storytelling about me, not the deranged millionaire or the resident expert, but me, John Hodgman, a white male monster with terrible facial hair staring down the second half of his life. And really enjoyed it. And then by the time Vacation Land started as a stand-up tour, I performed it in Boston before. And then I really wanted to expand it and make a record of it in all of its ungainly glory, and that's the book. And certainly by the time the book came out, everyone was doing fake facts by then. It was no longer cool.
I know, it was actually kind of a problem.
Someone stole my idea.
And used it for evil.
That's true. It's true. I'm sorry I made this incredible tool that is now being used for evil.
Well, you had mentioned facial hair.
Yes.
And you can see him right now with your full bearded glory.
Well, unglory, I think. Yeah.
Why did you make such a big deal about
the book opens hair? With my apology for my beard. I know what it looks like. It is not a very full or lustrous
Some
beard.
Some might think it's dapper. I don't know.
I don't know who you're talking about. Most people have major questions about why I grew this beard, and most of those people are my wife. And to them, I have to always say the same thing. I grew a mustache for the same reason all weird dads grow mustaches. It's the evolutionary signal to the world that they're all done. Our children are out there. Our DNA has been replicated. Our evolutionary purpose is no longer needed. So hello, mating people. No, thank you. But the beard was more of a compulsion. I think men have to grow a beard at least once in their life because they want to see what comes out of their face. What secret man is living inside of them that comes out in the mirror when they grow a beard?
And what was revealed to you?
Apparently I am the part-time bookkeeper for the Church of Satan. when it's trimmed nicely. No, I just have a slight, I have a pointy little goatee. I have a mustache that doesn't meet. I have a very unseemly sideburns that look like salt and pepper ants walking up and down my face. It's no good. When it's trimmed, I kind of have a demonic nerd look.
Demonic nerd, okay.
Yeah. And when it's getting a little bushy the way it is now, kind of feel like I don't look like the bookkeeper of the Church of Satan anymore. I look more like the IT guy for Duck Dynasty.
Okay.
You can decide.
That's something I'm never going to unsee now. So, you know, you gave your kind shout out to Brookline, Massachusetts. But really, we ought to talk about Western Massachusetts.
Pioneer Valley, Western Massachusetts.
Because that is where so much of your life, your real life and stories in your book take place.
Right. So I grew up in Brookline. I went to high school here. But my mom and dad were always fascinated with the Pioneer Valley around Franklin County, around Greenfield, Massachusetts. And they had a weekend house there. My mom passed away in 2000 and essentially left the house to me and my wife. We had just gotten married. So I'd spent a lot of time in my 20s and early teens visiting there, and then even longer once I got into my 30s and we were young and we had children. And we would spend a big chunk of time. As I mentioned, my wife's a high school teacher and I am unemployable. So we could spend a big chunk of time in a different part of the world and in a very rural part of the world, which is a new experience for me being a
asthmatic weirdo from not so suburban Boston.
So I mean, and you also talk about how it's really different for your kids, right? Because
yes.
it's a world apart from Brooklyn.
Yeah. Well, for example, my son, when we're in Western Massachusetts, will just spend all day playing Arkham Asylum on the PlayStation 3. We don't have Arkham Asylum in New York City where we live. So that's a big difference. That's an experience of the country that he gets to have. But more seriously, of course, we get to meet people from different walks of life. It's a very rural community. It's also a lot more conservative than it is here in the East. People think of Massachusetts and New England as this big blue monolith, but it's not, obviously. And my children can be out in the world having adventures, falling off of things, and risking death in different ways.
Absolutely. So, yeah. I mean, it's a kind of freedom that you don't necessarily have here in Greater Boston.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, did your experience in your time there, like, has it worked its way into your comedy?
I mean, sure. What Western Massachusetts and owning a home did was make us grow up. When you live in New York City, and any major city, Boston as well, you can prolong adolescence for a long time. You can think that you're still a young person. You don't have to drive. If you own your own place, which is impossible now in New York and Boston, but even if you get to that benchmark of adulthood, you're still living in an apartment probably, which is a glorified dorm room. You never have to clean a gutter or fix a plumbing. That's a thing, I guess. you just call some super or manager or whatever and some surrogate dad to come fix it. So once we were there in a freestanding home, we had no idea how to run it. We had to learn the hard way. Did you know, for example, if your home is heated by propane, the propane does not arrive by magic. I didn't realize that. But you have to, if you want propane to heat your home, you have to call the propane man. And if you don't call him, he will not come. And then you will show up in a cold, dark house with your baby in November wondering what happened. And it smells like garbage. And not because of the 5 bags of garbage you left in the garage 2 months ago when you didn't feel like going to the dump. It smells like garbage. The propane man tells you that it's the propane that smells like garbage on purpose.
Yeah.
So that you know when there's a gas leak.
And you don't die.
Right.
Right.
You know
exactly.
There's a gas leak or you know that you're about to run out.
Yeah.
And he said, the propane smells like garbage because you're garbage. You're garbage people who don't deserve to own a house. He didn't say that, but that's what I took it to mean.
Let me ask you sort of a writerly question here.
Sure.
Is it more or less challenging when, you know, writing about your own life sincerely than it is when, you know, you're doing your other books about that are so much fun, but about fake stuff?
It's easy to hide behind character when you're doing sort of absurdist humor. Even though I was always John Hodgman, the resident expert on The Daily Show, the resident expert was a disguise. It was a fun disguise because I could be a monster and say horrible things. And even more once I became the deranged millionaire and just talked about, you know, what was it? They call economics the dismal science.
Yeah.
Right. Because it was invented by Eustace Dismal, who was the first person to propose making smokestacks out of children rather than having children clean them. You know, that was the kind of monstrous stuff I could say. It is harder to just acknowledge that you are kind of a monster in different ways. To speak truly and honestly, I had to become more vulnerable and speak about my family. But mostly I speak about myself because I'm an only child and a narcissist. And the thoughts that go through my head and the privilege that I've enjoyed in my life.
Yeah.
You know.
One last quick question.
Yes.
And this is just, I'm taking it from the Washington Post here, because they described you as Garrison Keillor for Gen Xers. Do you like that?
Well, there's some parts of it I like and some parts that I hate. One, Gen Xers, it reminds me, I'm 46 years old. Do you remember when Gen X referred to a young generation?
Yeah.
Like that was like, we're the young ones, but now we're the...
Back when Ethan Hawke and Winona Ryder were actually kind of cool.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Well, yeah. Winona Ryder is still very cool.
Okay,
did you see that did you see she went she went out for Halloween dressed as herself?
No. Okay.
We still got some stuff, Gen X. We got some stuff to say. The Garrison Keillor thing... He was a hero of mine. His book, Happy to Be Here, was one of my formative dry humor texts. And, I had a chance to go on Prairie Home Companion with Chris Thiele, who just replaced him or took up that robe and is doing an amazing job. And I was overwhelmed with the sudden understanding of the incredible, 30-year work of art that he created. So I don't mind being compared to Garrison Keillor at all.
John Hodgman, we spoke with him about his book Vacation Land, True Stories from Painful Beaches, last November. And by the way, you can get a good look at what his beard looked like at the time. Go to radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, everyone, yeah, as you probably heard earlier in the hour, today is my last day as your host for Radio Boston. On August 20th, I'll be moving to 10 a.m. and hosting On Point with the terrific team there, and I am excited for this next kind of scary, kind of overwhelming step in my career. But I gotta tell you, it's also bittersweet because this job, sitting in this chair, working with that brilliant Radio Boston team and talking with all of you every day, well, it's been the most fulfilling, most enriching, most profound job I have had in my life thus far. I have loved it, and I've loved all of you. So this is going to be a bit self-indulgent, but I couldn't help it. I spent the day listening back to a bunch of my most memorable moments I've experienced on this show, and gosh darn it, there are many. We all have experienced a whole lot together in the past 8 years. So if I may, I just want to share some of those moments with you. I mean, of course, there is, first of all, April 15th, 2013. I got to start with that because it's the week that really changed us all. Radio Boston was on the air just a short time after those bombs exploded at the Boston Marathon. Hi, John. Can you hear us? Hi, John. First of all, I hope you're okay. It's obviously very loud there. If you can hear me, tell us what you saw.
What I saw is I was walking down the street and I felt a massive percussion. There was definitely an explosion. It wasn't until I turned around that I realized that one had gone off behind me as well.
I mean, we'll never forget that week. And that's what the thing is about this job. It brings you into contact with people who have truly suffered in their lives, but so many of them are still trying to make a difference. Back in 2016, I got a chance to talk with Maureen Maloney. Her son had actually been killed by an undocumented immigrant, so she publicly threw her support behind then-candidate Donald Trump. I talked with her for a long time, and after that conversation, I finally had to ask her if she worried that she'd been politicizing her son's death, and here's what she said to me.
And there really is no moving on. It's really just a matter of learning how to live without your child. So no grieving family should ever be judged on how they're dealing with their grief. So just have compassion for grieving families.
Yeah. Then there was Harvard professor Danielle Allen. She'd written about her cousin Michael, who'd been incarcerated as a juvenile and later killed. It's a beautiful book she's written called Cuz. And I'd noticed throughout our conversation that Danielle had been swinging back and forth between talking about mass incarceration in the abstract and feeling the real pain it had caused her family.
Yeah, no, it's hard. I mean, you know, the whole point of being an academic is that you don't do this kind of thing. But so I'm grateful to Michael because one of the things I've learned from doing this is just how important it is. Sorry. Even as an academic, to put head and heart together.
Head and heart together. That is what this program has aimed for and will continue to aim for. And I remember really feeling that, you know, we hit it when we did this huge series on housing and evictions in Boston a couple of years ago. There are so many important policy questions to debate in this booming city, and every one of those policies ultimately translate into real effects on real people's lives. People like Olga Pasco, an East Boston resident who we talked to who was living in a church.
Yes, this is where we live, thanks to Pastor Don. He opened the doors for us to live here because the landlords, who have all the money in the world, they threw us out on the streets without compassion. They knew we were human beings, but nothing mattered to them.
Listening back to Olga's story reminded me, later of a completely different story we had reported out in Pittsfield. Do you all remember in early 2016 when GE made those headlines announcing its new global headquarters were coming to Boston? It was one of those moments where all of us, Boston, was looking to the future. But GE's past history in this state really still casts a long shadow, particularly in Pittsfield, which is still cleaning up from decades of GE's PCB contamination of the Housatonic River. So we went out to Pittsfield, and we talked to 87-year-old Nick Borowski, a former GE manager, and he made a really startling admission to us.
One thing I can say about the use of Pyrenol is I was the guy who ordered it to be stopped. All right.
When did you do that?
1977.
Why'd you do that?
Because I didn't want the government yelling at me. Not because I thought it was dangerous. Okay.
So you can see what I'm getting at here. This has been such a privilege to do this job. A real privilege. Because Boston, you are a study in contrasts on some of the most important issues we face, and you have been willing to talk with us from all sides of those contrasts. I mean, take our extended coverage of the charter school cap ballot question back in 2016. One of our many days covering that vote, we talked with two Boston parents. First, Keisha Lewis, you'll hear. She opposed expanding charter schools.
For my own kids, I want to keep them in public school because we have to make public school accountable. If something's not working, we don't just throw it away and ditch that idea and go somewhere else. No, we make it work here. Well, you know what? If that's the case, let's make sure that we get the job done in the public sector where we're supposed to do it.
Well, that same day, we heard from Shalina Semexent, who desperately wanted more charters.
My daughter's with them being left behind. This might be another wasted year of her not getting caught up to where she needs to be. I mean, moms tell me, they share my story. But I say to them, why aren't you standing with me?
So, you know, we here at Public Radio, we try to keep it civil. But I have to admit, things are pretty heated in America and even right here in Massachusetts right now. And sometimes I'm not quite sure how I handled the heat. Here's a little montage from some punchy politicians.
You're defending her.
I am not defending
you
her.
You are. She voted for the Monsanto Protection Act. Let's look at it. She voted yay.
I am offering context for
that. Well, why?
That
why not
vote?
Look at the
because
actual context?
Because that's my job. But I was going to ask
Call me Attorney Lively.
If you are
I'm willing to
I would like to actually complete
statement.
The sentence so that
right,
listeners know what our guidelines are. In fact, I thought it was a mark of respect because faith is a large part of who you are
sure,
to call you pastor.
Sure.
If you want me to call you Attorney Lively, it is my pleasure to do so.
Thank
it is
you.
Nothing
Thank
personal.
You.
Congressman,
we are the moderators here. I will give you a chance to respond.
We just raised transportation in Chelsea.
I will give you a chance.
We need to recognize that 5 years
give
ago there was no silver line in Chelsea.
I'm not talking
the
silver
about line
on.
Now goes
I'm
to Chelsea.
I'm talking about the bus.
Ladies and gentlemen,
both of you, please. We will give you chances to respond.
Which we did. Those are three of my more challenging moments from our political coverage. But you know what? One of the greatest, greatest, greatest joys of this job is getting to talk to all the amazing inventors, innovators, entrepreneurs, and wildly creative human beings we've got around here. Too many of those conversations to count, so I just kind of randomly picked one. Here's a moment from one of my favorites, Tim Berners-Lee, the guy who invented the web.
And we're sitting right at the bottom of a huge dumpster, quite an operation, and took it home. And then I went down to the TV shop and I asked the guy.
Let me just jump in here for a second to say that the inventor of the web still exudes enthusiasm and excitement for that first computer he ever built with a couple of old TVs that cost him less than £10. He spent several minutes of our interview walking us through all the details of its construction.
Now, I could have used the same technology of soldering together little integrated circuits to make a computer. I basically knew how to do it. But it would have been an awful lot of soldering.
I mean, really, truthfully, we spent like 20 minutes talking about the first computer he ever built in intimate detail. And then there's this incredibly sweet moment from Chef Joanne Chang when she was telling me about how she could have never launched the very first flour bakery and cafe if it hadn't been for her mom, who tirelessly stood at the counter in those early days calling customers to come get their sandwiches.
It was like a mom calling you for dinner. So she would say, Magna! 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 Come get your sandwich! And I think if you're in the audience, I mean, if you're in the dining room, you're like, oh my gosh, somebody's mom is really upset that they're not coming for dinner. Because she would just, like, shout. She would, like, wait patiently for, like, a second. And then if you didn't come right then and get your sandwich, she'd be like, ah! And you'd just sit there in the dining room, and I'd have to say, Mom, you have to calm down. She's like, well, their sandwich is going to get old.
Finally, one more little moment I just have to share with you, because being a part of this show has given me access to the history we are all surrounded by and living with in ways that I could have never imagined. So just listen to this, a moment I'll never forget, 2012, on the deck of the USS Constitution. It is still a commissioned vessel, so there are actual sailors on board.
Yes, there are actual sailors on board, and we're standing on the top deck here, on the spar deck, as the first duty crew is being mustered. It's just a little before 8 o'clock in the morning, and we're actually waiting for the cannon to go off.
Here it comes.
Oh, my God! Oh, my God! I felt the pressure wave go across my ears.
Good morning. Welcome aboard.
Welcome aboard. Thank you to the Radio Boston team who've made this show. You have made this show the gem that it is, and you will keep it strong and surprising. And I want to thank you to everyone who's listened to me to try to figure this all out over the past 8 years. Boston, you are a study in contrasts. Too self-congratulatory, I think, but also knows... You know how far we all still have to go. That deep history, while also diving in headfirst into the future. You're all a bit curmudgeonly, but this is a place where we form friendships for life. Hosting this show, talking with and meeting so many of you has taught me so much. You have all made me a better person, a better parent, and a better citizen. I have genuinely loved being with you. Thank you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.